during the session, and if it's too dark in here that you're falling asleep, I want the person next to you to give you the elbow, okay? But I see people aren't sitting next to people that much. But anyway, more people will come in. So we now have the pleasure of listening to Elena Benedicto, who is going to talk about participatory documentation in between Mayana linguists and in the Mayana linguist team of Nicaragua.
So we were talking about the adjacency of the two nasals there in Mayana, and now we got stuck in this. It's, I'm not a phonologist, so. So what I want to talk about here is this initiative, this ongoing action that we have in Nicaragua, and to show how we, in the context of Nicaragua, have implemented a model of interaction between outsider linguists, inside linguists, and the community. And so the talk intersects two of the themes of the conference, that of community-based initiatives and that of collaborative teams, and it does so articulating through the participatory action research approach. On the Mayana side, in the Mayana community, we are interacting with Huracán University, which is a local university with, at least in principle, very good mission and vision, and its linguistics institute, the IPILC, and associated with them are our Mayana collaborators, Antolín Dolores Fenley Gómez y Salomón. And on the external side, it's Purdue University, the Indigenous and Endangered Languages Lab there, and myself and Viñas and Eggleston, two PhD students that are sitting there. So what is participatory research? Or at least how can it be understood in the context of linguistics? I want to say that it's a way of articulating those three modules that we many times are confronted with or are exposed to: the research module, the community module, and then what I want to add there is the linguistic training. So in a nutshell, what participatory action research is imply an active participation of the members of the community, but this usually, at least even in the context of Nicaragua, is understood as, oh, they come, they tell us their story. No, the thing is that the members of the community must be agents in the process of discovery of knowledge. That's the way agentivity is understood. Not informants, not objects of study, not even participants in a blind way. And what for? Well, the self-empowerment of the community, and this self is very important, I think, because in English, you don't distinguish between the intransitive and accusative use of verbs and the transitive one. So empower, it's sometimes used as a transitive verb, and it shouldn't be understood in that way. So the empowerment comes from within the community. And in the end, it's a rebalancing of the power relationships that are taking place. So the way I'm going to organize this talk is by setting up the issue first, then talking about the basis of the whole approach, the concrete implementation that we did in Nicaragua, and the consequences of that approach beyond the field. So, usually when you have a linguistic research project, you initiate a contact to a language community, and in that first action already you have an imbalance created. And that imbalance comes from the fact that the linguist is an outsider, it's a member of a dominant culture, and has power of decisions about who, the what, the how, and almost everything. Whereas in the language community, the power of decision is very intangible, if it is there at all. So one of the things that we want to do is when we have that situation there, that relationship established between the linguistic research and the language community, what can we do to improve that imbalance? And the first step that we can think of is a rebalancing or a redistribution of agentivity. And we think that one way of accomplishing there or getting closer to that redistribution of agentivity is through linguistic training. So if we had a linguist being an outsider and a member of the dominant culture, through linguistic training, what we can do is that the linguist becomes an insider, it's an insider, and a member of the language community and culture. And that way, maybe we can change the power of decision about the who, the what, and the how. The second step that we may take is ensure a good flow of knowledge, which implies, as we will see later, that we need to recognize that there are different knowledges, different types of knowledge, and that they all are equal. So if we have the language community, the linguistic research, and the linguistic training, we have to ensure that the language community infuses what we do in linguistic research and that it also permeates the linguistic training. That linguistic research get, or the results of it also go back to the community and to the linguistic training, and that what happens out of the linguistic training, because things will happen, also go back and inform both the linguistic project and the community, that it can not only inform but also enrich the language community. And we have to also ensure that that keeps going, that that's a dynamic process. And so by doing that, we also hope that the power imbalances will be shifted or re-established. So let's see now that basis three-pillar platform, for lack of a better word. So the three pillars are the basic principles, the guiding principles that we have to have in mind whenever we do anything about this. The general goals are the specific goals that, in this case, for Nicaragua, we wanted to accomplish. And then the implementation mechanisms is the concrete specific mechanisms that we use to obtain the goals. So for basic principles, as I said before, recognize that there are knowledge systems of different kinds and of equal value, that we need to establish an egalitarian relationship, and that there must be that one of the ulterior goals that we want to obtain is self-empowerment of the language community. The specific goals that we wanted for this concrete project was to create a local indigenous linguist team, to develop a participatory dynamic within the dealings of that group, and to create materials that are relevant to the community. As you see, it's like almost a mirror image of the general principles above. And the implementation mechanisms that we are going to be using is a joint decision-making process, a continuous training program, and a self-evaluation mechanism. The last one, we added the last, and I think that has been one of the most useful elements in this whole enterprise. So how did we implement this? Let's talk first about participants and location, the individual goals of all those elements there, the how we integrate and articulate them, and I think that the crucial point here is the articulation idea, and then how we evaluate that implementation. So we are there in Central America, Nicaragua, a country that is divided culturally and linguistically in two areas. The west one is colonized by the Spaniards, and the east one colonized by the British, but only on the coast. And so the rest of the people were left alone. Within that eastern coast, the Mayangna or Sumu, it's another name, are in those isolated places. So we meet in a central location where we all come from different places and work there. It's a mestizo town. Spanish is spoken all over, and we have Miskito in the north, Creole in the south, and Vamangarifuna also in the south. So it's a multicultural, multilingual situation. So let's see what the individual goals of if each of those components are. The community goals and actions are motivated by the cultural interests of the community, and I think that we have heard in the previous talk a lot about that. They were interested in collecting and getting and recovering traditional folk tales, traditional songs, oral history, especially of leaders, old leaders, past heroes, community events, and endogenous technology, because it was getting lost. And this is where the articulation part comes. At the same time that we are doing this, because this is what the community wanted, what we are obtaining is free, spontaneous language data that will fit into the research, okay? And the other part that we did was people began to want to tell their story and want to tell what they wanted. So one of the things that we did was to design interviews to women, elders, and students, and we used the questions to obtain targeted spontaneous language data. And that basically gave us a lot of data about one of the projects that we were doing about modality, and that also fed into the research part. But most importantly, how we did it gave us training opportunities for the community team, and so it fed into the linguistic training component. So as you see, one single action is feeding all three components and contributing to each one of them. On the research part, we, as always, want to have descriptions of the language. We want grammars and dictionaries. Crucially, though, what we need is that those dictionaries and grammars are of use to the community. So most of the ways that we do grammars and dictionaries are not useful to the community. So one of the things that we are doing is the grammar that we are writing is written in Mayangna completely, no translation. And that is to be used in the training, in the bachelor's degree of bilingual education by the university. So the goal is to teach those classes in Mayangna using Mayangna bibliography and conducting the whole thing in Mayangna. The dictionary is a monolingual dictionary. It's a database that has produced different kinds of dictionary. Little ones for kids with drawings and so on. And also the last one that we are working on is a monolingual dictionary with definitions in the language so that it can be used in the bilingual educational system. So in that way, doing it that way, we feed into the community. What we do for the linguistic project has an output into the community. And then we also like to do analysis, right? We love doing analysis. So one of the things that we had been working on was the model constructions and classifier auxiliaries, and that, the way we dealt with that and the way we analyzed that, fed perfectly the linguistic training component. Yes, it was slower. Yes, we didn't get a lot done every summer that we went there. But the benefits of training the linguistic team was invaluable. And eventually you get things done anyway. For linguistic training, remember that the goal was to create a local indigenous team. So the means were first a bachelor's degree in bilingual education that the local university set up. Out of that one, I taught for the first years that I was there, 3-4 years, I taught. And out of that teaching came a bunch of like 8 to 9 people that were interested in what we were doing in class. And for those people, we did postgraduate courses in linguistics after they finished the bachelor's degree, and we did specific linguistic workshops. And out of those is when we began to do the specific linguistic training on the mechanics of data collection, on the analysis of data. And that goes again back to the research, beyond Huracan and returning to the community the results of that research. We also prepared the books and materials and teacher training. And the last step is professional development, where you have the members of the team that were students in Huracan now teaching at Huracan, participating in conferences and writing research projects. And because I have very little time, I'll just go through the pictures of the things. These are BA thesis defenses, all written in Mayangna. It was the first time that anything scientific was written in Mayangna, and we had to fight for it, but we did it. And professional development, teaching at Huracan, and presenting at conferences. So how do we integrate all the components? We have an initial meeting where we do brainstorming, and the decision-making process takes place. We plan, and we evaluate whatever has happened before. And if nothing has happened before, then we continue. We have twice a year workshops, short, intensive. We begin always with an evaluation of what has happened before. That keeps us very focused on what we want to accomplish and takes away the details of life that happened to everybody. And I think that's a very good process. We do analysis and the linguistic training sessions and more planning. Planning and evaluation, two very necessary parts of it. During the intersession work periods, there is data collection and preliminary data processing, both in Nicaragua and in the States. So does it work? Well, the original goal was to have linguists that were members of the community and to rebalance power inequalities. Well, yes, there is a team of indigenous linguists. They are participating in key professional positions, and the presence of women has increased exponentially. So those are the good things. But there are different individual goals, and those goals are shifting. And the goals of the community and the goals of the individuals, as all of you know, not always go in sync. So that has been one of the problems that we need to address. With power comes responsibility, and responsibility requires going after people, trying to get things done, taking care of the money, and that is that's a load. And is power rebalanced? That's the big if. Well, that's in progress matter. The control of the money is still in the hands of the outsiders, and that's because the writing project part was in hands of the outsiders. So one of the things that we are trying now is to do some training on project writing so that the team can themselves write the project, and so they will be in control of the money. Consequences beyond the field. How much do I have? 2 minutes. Some basic, I want to throw out there some questions that have been floating here in this conference. And eventually, not answers, I know I can't get answers, but I would like to shape them a little bit better. The source of knowledge, who has the knowledge? Who knows? What constitutes knowledge? I still have quite a bit of my colleagues thinking that the knowledge is in our side, that we are the ones that know, and so we have to decide. And that is related to an idea, this idea of the colonization of knowledge that has been floating around in many of the talks that I've been at. And I think that that idea needs to permeate our Western institutions much more than, or at least in the Midwest, much more than it has. Whose priority? Whose goal have priority? And when priority needs to be established. Again, same thing as before. Western institutions always have priority. Our CVs always have priority. And how knowledge is distributed and disseminated. I don't know what happens in other places, but most of the work that has been done in these languages in the last 100 years is published in German and in English. And none of those two languages are accessible to the population in Nicaragua. So they don't know anything that has been said about their language. The dissemination has served the purposes of the academics that wrote them, me included, but it hasn't reached the owners of the language, which comes down to the last question, who owns the language and who controls the language. I'm going to skip then all these things that Western institutions are doing. I'm going to throw there some questions about the field methods class in Western-style institution. What's the role of the speaker? It's totally undefined. It's totally unrecognized. It's someone that at least you pay and disappear. But there is no discussion about the rights of the speaker in the community and the right of return to know what is being said about my language and how I can get back that part of the knowledge and what the responsibility of the research there is. So let me finish by saying that what I have presented is a collaborative system that tries to articulate the needs of everybody involved in that little intersection there, and that recognizes different knowledges are involved, that tries to rebalance the power relations involved. The emphasis is on the process. That's the output, that's the result, the process itself, and it's work in progress. We have had some successes, but there is way more to do. And thank you very much, and I'll let you with the mango tree and the witch.
Elena, how would I thank you in Mayanga?
Tinki palmi. Tinki, unfortunately, is it's a low.
No
long word from English, because they don't, they think by actions, not by words. So.
Questions then, would you say your name for the audio recording device?
Amy Schaefer, UH. I think this whole project sounds really exciting in terms of the amount of success you have, you know, recognizing that there are difficulties as well. One of the tough things seems to me getting started. Can you talk a little bit about now having gone farther, sort of what advice you would have for building this sort of approach elsewhere?
We had the best possible situation. They called us. So
barring that.
I think that in my view, and what I was thinking when I was a graduate student when I began this, I had finished my journals papers, I had a year ahead of me, and I went to Ken Hale and I said, hey, I want to do some field work before these guys tell me to write a dissertation now. And so I had a way of introducing, getting there myself. But I think that the idea that I had was that I had to give something before I could take anything. So for many years, on that teaching that I did there, I actually didn't do any linguistic work. And, as a graduate student, I'm not sure that I would recommend that to anybody because I got in trouble. Because I was spending too much time there. What is your dissertation? I didn't use any of that for my dissertation because I didn't want to use it. But in the end, Ken Hale told me, if you don't do any research on it, then you are not going to be able to contribute anything to the development of the studies in the language. So then I began to work, trying to always be able to give something at the same time that I was taking something. But I think that for me, the important part that was that I gave something first before I took anything. And I think that that way, and also one of the things, I wasn't aware of that then, but one of the things that I've been hearing later is people come and they take and they leave and they never return, never say anything. So the fact that I was coming back and that they knew that I was coming back and that they could ask me things to bring back because they knew that I was coming back. So that stability, if you want, of the going back.
Greg Orman, SIL. I was a little bit curious about your comment about your dictionary being useful for bilingual education and that you wanted it to be a monolingual dictionary.
I didn't.
That's what they wanted.
That was our joint decision.
Okay. Because in our situation, our dictionary, our language consultant wanted a combination monolingual bilingual dictionary. So he wanted vernacular definitions plus definitions in the national language plus definitions in English, and he felt that that would be very attractive to people who needed to look.
Well, what they want is the translations. So the definition, and also because they were doing the work, writing definitions is very difficult.
Yes.
Not easy at all. And they discovered that. And then just the thought of translating all that to Miskito, which is the other language, and to Spanish, was daunting. So they settled on just the definition in Mayanga, that's good enough. And then the translation of the lemma, of the word, in Spanish, and eventually in English, they were interested in that. So eventually, maybe what we will be able to have is a reverse dictionary, English, for instance. They were very interested in English. English Mayanga. But it is crucial that, I mean, one of the things is that this language has two or three variants. And so, and it's a powerful identity thing. And so we have been working with two variants, Panamaca, which is the majority, and Tuaca, which is the minority. And so the idea, also because it's going to cost money and everything, was to make one single dictionary and to either divide two parts or mix them and identify the ones that are Tuaca or Panamaca. And we had a bunch of discussions over the years. We've been doing that forever, this dictionary. And so they vehemently opposed to be in the same book as the Panamaca. No way. So, okay, it's going to be more expensive. We'll have to look for more money. But the Tuaca will have their dictionary, even if 50% of their words are going to be the same. And the Panamaca will have their dictionary. That's their decision.
Well, seeing as nobody else is asking questions, I'll ask another one. How did you go about training people to write the vernacular definition? Because we ended up giving up because it was just too hard.
Oh, I'm very persistent. No, and they had trouble in the beginning, but once you get into it, then it's easier. The only thing that they were trying not to talk to me, because whenever they talked about something, we discovered a new word, and new word, lexical entry, definition and everything, and then they were like,
So you ran some training courses?
All these linguistic workshops, everything that we do, all the analysis of the language is working in the...
Yeah, but specifically about writing the definition.
Oh, yes.
The whole course. How
yes.
long?
Yes, yes.
How much teaching time?
How much teaching time?
Yeah, to teach them to write a vernacular definition.
I don't know. We are very flexible and very fluid. There is no teaching and then sitting down to do it.
Were you talking 2 weeks or 5 months? Or
we
or
did,
very
okay, so in the beginning we did maybe a 2-week workshop, but we were doing more than that. Then every 6 months I was going there, and every 6 months we were revising what we had done, so that became also a teaching training workshop. So maybe the whole thing began to be more or less good, that is not repeating the defined word, being informative on that stuff, maybe after 3 to 4 years. But in the process, we learned a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that's the emphasis on the process. It doesn't, I mean, we've been doing that for 10 years now. Mm-hmm. We still haven't published the dictionary.
Okay.
But it's getting closer. And everything that we have learned in the process, and the fact that they are now presenting in conferences, that has been the big output of it, not the concrete dictionary.
Yeah,
Evelyn
Fogwood. I wanted to ask, didn't you think that it was much appropriate to start with mini dictionaries so that...
Yeah, we did that.
Okay.
Yeah. We did for children.
Mm-hmm.
So we had one where most of the people that work with me are women, and they are teachers. So what we decided to do was to go to the back to the schools, organize the kids.
Mm-hmm.
That was a school activity. And they had pre-selected words. So for each letter, they had identified the words that corresponded to things that were drawable and that were at the level of the kids. And so there was their previous word first. And then they set up all the kids to draw. And they draw with colors. We bought the colors, the
crayons
and stuff like that. We did a whole school activity, and then we took what they did, we scan it, and then we put it together in, I don't know, what it was, in some software, in PowerPoint maybe. And so in that part, we involved some of the students at Purdue, and then we created a PDF that we sent back to be printed there. So we have that. There is a collection of stories that has been published. There is a something that has not been published yet, which is a dictionary by content. So it has the body parts. It goes from the kid onto the community, onto the mountains, onto. So it has trees and fruits and stuff like that. And we tried to do it in color. I mean, that delayed the thing a lot because you needed to have more money. But I think it is important because it was very clear that the guys in the Pacific were getting everything in color. And when anything was printed there, was at least, at most, in 3 colors.
Yeah.
And I wanted full color. And it was so amazing because they kept asking, are you sure you want full color? Yes.
Let's thank Elena.